Hello, and thank you for joining us. This is the fourth of four Climate Bite episodes we recorded as part of this year's Art Plus Climate Equals Change 2019 Festival by Climart. This makes it the last Climate Bites, which is quite bittersweet. We've learned so much from these four episodes, from the excellent guests both inside the University of Melbourne faculty and outside, the excellent moderator who wrangled it all together, Dr. Renee Beale, from the Royal Society of Victoria. We learned about water, about food, about fashion, and lastly, today, how we interact with nature through the lens of the law. I'd like to take a moment to thank Climart for making it possible to record these sessions and release them as podcasts for you. Meaning if you weren't there, you didn't miss out. And even if you were there, you can re-listen and pick up on more that you missed anytime you want. And so without further ado, here's episode 4 of 4 of our Climate Bites miniseries. Enjoy.
Hello, my name is Bronwyn Johnson and I'm the director of Art Plus Climate Equals Change 2019 Festival, presented by Climart. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which the festival takes place and acknowledge the Wurundjeri people on whose lands the program you are about to hear was staged and recorded. Art Plus Climate Equals Change 2019 is a socially engaged festival of ideas, exhibitions and events, presenting over 30 curated exhibitions at leading museums and galleries in Melbourne and regional Victoria. The 2019 Festival considers ideas and concepts around art and activism, community engagement, transition and accelerated action on climate change. In this festival, artists, curators, scientists and policy experts envisage a world where we protect and care for our Earth, from the river systems, oceans and lands to the air we breathe. As we know, actions to reduce global warming will only arise from communities based upon fairness, Indigenous knowledge, cooperation and through valuing the arts and sciences. Let's join now with the artists, curators, scientists and policy experts through this festival program, Climate Bites, at the Living Pavilion at the University of Melbourne.
Welcome to Climate Bites, a program presented as part of Climart's Art Plus Climate Equals Change 2019 Festival. My name is Renee Beale and I'm the producer of Climate Bites. So these are lunchtime info-packed discussions with experts on water, food, fast fashion and nature. So hopefully you'll take away some practical knowledge and some tips to bite back against our climate emergency. This is actually the last of our Climate Bites discussion series and we're going to talk about nature today. So Climate Bites is being held on the lands of the Wurundjeri people and I wish to acknowledge them as the traditional owners. The Wurundjeri are this region's first scientists, patiently observing and sometimes gently shaping the ecosystem they so effectively cared for thousands of years. As a scientist who studied at this great university, I am humbled by the deep knowledge of the Wurundjeri and other Indigenous communities, and I feel incredibly grateful for their generosity in reaching out to educate and work with scientists in how we can best care for country together. Now to nature. Humans delight in and find themselves in awe of nature. The soaring kestrel, a rugged mountain range. The beauty of flowers, birds, and beetles. Yet humans have plundered nature's riches. And according to the recently released UN Biodiversity Report, brought more than 1 million further species to the brink of extinction worldwide. In Australia, the pressures of climate change, pollution, land clearing and invasive species place more than 1,800 plant and animal species and woodlands, forests and wetlands at risk of extinction. What role can the law play in protecting nature? What role can individuals and communities play? Instead of well-trodden ancient Greek philosophical views that nature is all around us, but somehow separate from us, how can we change or reshape our beliefs so that we acknowledge that humans are part of nature? Nature is within us. Nature includes us. Care for ourselves, therefore, must then include care for our environment. Nature creates music for those who listen. How can we hear the lyrics and lend our voices to protect nature's song? Joining us today for this illuminating discussion on the Thursday, the 16th of May, and to help unpack some of the questions are Professor Lee Godden and Professor Mark Elgar. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of a bio of our panel today so that you know who you're asking questions of and what their expertise is. So Professor Mark Elgar is Professor of Evolutionary Biology and Animal Behaviour at the University of Melbourne. His research explores sexual selection, social behaviour and chemical communication primarily in birds and insects. He has been investigating how air pollution may be interfering with insects' capacity to communicate and ability to thrive. Professor Lee Godden is the director of the Centre for Resources, Energy and Environmental Law at the University of Melbourne. Her work engages with public interest issues such as the impact of climate change on environmental law and water law, land rights and economic development for Indigenous communities. So to start us off today, I'll ask the first question of the panel, but if you'd like to ask a question, please just raise your hand and we'll fit you into the discussion as we're going along. Also, I've been asked by Mark, who's doing the podcast, he'll run over and make sure he captures your question with his microphone. Lee, now scientists are now starting to discover incredible evidence about plants actually communicating, as well as, you know, we kind of are aware that animals have their own language, but plants are something that perhaps we haven't necessarily been aware that are actually doing a lot of chatter amongst themselves. Is some of that research actually filtering in into environmental law at all, or is that something that's sort of not quite there yet?
I think this is an important way of breaking down some of the stereotypes about the way in which law plays a role in addressing issues such as climate change, its engagement on environmental questions of protection and so on. Because, in fact, there is research by my colleague Afshin Akhavari about how law might tap into those ideas of plants communicating. And this represents a part of a change where law is very much engaged in thinking about how it manifests in a direct spatial time and scale sense in the environment. So this has been part of work that is not only there in environmental law, but some of my colleagues in the law school actually deal with the question of law and sound. And so we have had a lot of work come through around, for example, law and aesthetics and how that informs our understanding of concepts that are embedded in law, such as property law, such as giving effect to environmental protection through world heritage. So I'd really like to have questions that engage with this wider understanding that we are starting to bring to law, which is that we've been deaf for so long to lots of voices that we're now just starting to understand.
Does anyone have any questions for Lee on that, or will I allow that to percolate in your minds while I build another kind of complex layer on that, which is some of Mark Elgar's work understanding communication within insect and bird populations? Do you want to start speaking a little bit about some of your work, particularly as it relates to humans' impact on communication within insect and bird populations?
Sure. So it's certainly true that there's a great deal of sound kicking around that we may or may not hear, and some sound which actually interferes with our ability to hear. For example, vehicles going past on the roadsides. And that has implications for a range of particularly animals that communicate by sounds, particularly birds that find that they're unable to hear each other in environments which are particularly noisy. There's a lot of research kicking around, or I should say research that's been undertaken that demonstrates that either birds will, for example, moderate the sounds that they make to compensate for the background noise, or in other instances, they're not able to thrive particularly well. One of the things that members of my group work with is another form of, or another modality of communication, which is smell. As humans, this is not something that we appreciate particularly well, because we're actually not very good at detecting smells except the most obvious kind. But for an insect flying into, for example, a meadow with a large number of flowers, it's faced with an extraordinary challenge of being able to detect the odor of particular flowers that are suited for pollinating, for example, by that insect. So there is a cacophony of odors out there. We're not able to detect chemical signals or chemical odors as a form of communication different from sound, is that you can hear me simply by the vibrations that go through the air at you, which your eardrums pick up. But if we communicated by smell, for example, if I was wearing a perfume, then the only way that you would be able to detect that odor is if those perfume molecules actually interacted with the receptors that you find in your nose. In other words, the communication is quite different because it actually involves a physical entity moving through the environment. And one of the problems, an emerging interest amongst very few scientists at the moment, is how our polluting the air is having an effect on the ability of insects to communicate. And this operates in two ways. The pollutants in the air actually degrade the odor so that it doesn't reach its intended receiver. And the other damage, or the other form of pollution, is that the small particles that are found in the polluted air will aggregate on the body of insects, including on their antennae, and that makes it difficult for them to detect those odors as well. We think that this may be a part of the contributing factor that's responsible for the massive decline in number of insects that we see globally. And we might tend to think that this is an urban issue, but don't forget these pollutants, these air pollutants, travel great distances. And so, so this would explain why we're seeing declines in insect numbers, both in rural and urban areas, but also in what might otherwise seem like a pristine environment.
Is it at all reasonable to think that if we have a massive decline in the amount of insects that we can expect a functioning biosphere? Or is that really naive to think we can survive without insects?
The question is, should we care? And for those of you who work or have been affected by malaria or don't like getting bitten by mosquitoes, I would imagine that you would feel good about the elimination of mosquitoes. I certainly do, even though I'm quite passionate about insects. But more broadly, they are massively important. So there are two groups of insects that allow us to eat vegetables. To some extent, bees, and to perhaps a greater extent, a group of flies called hoverflies. They're important because they pollinate. You don't get tomatoes unless your flowers are being pollinated. So no insects, no pollinators. And there are heaps of other insects that have what we call these, we sometimes refer to them as ecosystem engineers, and they're critically important for a range of functioning activities. So yes, absolutely, we should care about insects, even though they don't necessarily have the charm of the charismatic megafauna that people get very excited about. But they probably have more impact on life than panda bears.
So are they able to adapt to climate change?
It depends a little bit on the kind of insect that you're talking about, but the ability to when you say adapt to change to changing circumstances depends on the generation time of insects. And most insects have a very short generation time. So flies, for example, will go through from egg to adult and die, you know, within weeks. Other insects that many of you may have encountered, some of the beautiful stick insects, for example, will live a lot longer. Honeybee queens live for about 30 years, I think, so, or can live up to that long. So being an insect doesn't necessarily mean that you're short-lived, but for bees in particular, the ability of them to adapt to change is actually tougher because their generation times are quite slow. A whole nest has to grow into a stage where they're starting to produce reproductives, and those reproductives In fact, it becomes even more complicated than that, because the workers that might be affected by the environmental change, the genetics of changing those becomes more complicated because they aren't actually reproducing. But that's, I guess I'm just saying it's more complicated. But because insects are short-lived, the tendency of people to think is, yes, they will adapt very quickly. And some can and some can't. But the other thing, too, is that to adapt, you require the genetic variation, the variants that would allow that kind of change to take place.
Can I also just come in on a point of intersection with law there? Because many of the endangered species lists and so on typically downplay the importance of insects, and you were talking about megafauna. What we have in many of our existing laws is a bias, if you like, towards megafauna and protection of megafauna. And so updating and ensuring that we give attention to a wide range of biodiversity is a really important thing that we're just starting to think about, thinking about habitats rather than just species in a whole range of laws. So those are at least the beginnings of a recognition that we need to take into account insects.
There's actually, if I might just add a complication to that too, so there's only, I think, globally a single wild population of dromedary camels, and they're found in Australia. So a massively endangered species globally is actually a pest environmentally in Australia, and the same goes for rabbits. So in certain parts of Europe, they're considered to be endangered. Foxes are endangered in Britain. So it becomes really complicated, I think, particularly in a legal context. And my view is the easiest way of getting around that is to stop thinking about species, think at habitat, and those parts of issues cease to be in effect. So yes, looking at Brumbies is a wonderful thing, but a very modern thing in Australia. But from a plant perspective, you know, if you heard a plant scream every time it got crushed by a Brumby, you would probably have a slightly different view about their appropriateness in, for example, mountain ranges.
Yes, thanks for the question. Certainly the idea of whether free trade agreements will impact on biodiversity protection has been an issue raised quite frequently. There are protections in relation to certain free trade agreements, and you have to look at the detail of the actual agreements. There were encouraging moves around some of the Asia-Pacific free trade agreements to actually include environmental sustainability as core conditions in there. But we certainly need to be alive to the idea that international law and trade agreements need to be cognizant of impacts around biodiversity protection, climate change impacts, and so on. And there are moves, it's yet, I would say, still tentative, to bring together things like the World Trade Organization and intellectual property regimes more into sync with an understanding of the need for environmental protection and protection of biodiversity.
I wanted to bring up something that I know you've got interesting views on, and I'd like us to discuss that, actually, around recent moves in some of the, New Zealand, but also in some of the Northern Hemisphere, to begin to award personhood status, like personhood legal status, to things like rivers and natural environments. And there have been some calls for that to start occurring in Australia. Can you explain what that actually means in terms of law, and why or why not that might be a good idea, or what an alternative might be that might be better than that?
Okay, thank you. And yes, there's been an absolute explosion in this idea of legal rights for nature. And one of the things I'd like to introduce is that much of the thinking around legal personhood actually is a translation from Indigenous concepts. because the idea of a living entity and the what is known in law as personhood actually is embedded in many Indigenous philosophies. And the example that gave rise to it in New Zealand, in fact, arose out of a process of settlement and compensation for Maori people as part of the Waitangi settlement process. So what has been picked up and popularised does not, in my view, give particular provenance to the contribution of Indigenous peoples in this idea of personhood. And I would say within Australia, we have had that concept for at least 20 years. We just don't recognise it as such. It's called native title, because native title recognises Indigenous relationships with land and waters, and it recognises that connection as part of a relationship with entities that are animate and living, and, for example, with dreaming stories and dreaming tracks that are seen as having personality in the sense that we understand it in Western terms. I also have some concerns about the idea, the very individualistic idea of legal rights for nature that, again, reinforces a very Western philosophical position around rights. And I think we need to start, yes, embracing these ideas for legal rights, but thinking collectively about how we bring protections. And often, particularly in situations, for example, in Colombia and in India, where we've seen legal rights for rivers, often these are last-ditch measures where environmental degradation is at such an extreme example that courts step in. I think that we need to see a much more broadly based approach that deals with, for example, planning. And the thing that many people don't realise is that the New Zealand examples around forestry, rights for forest, personhood for forests and rivers, is actually aligned to incorporation with co-management regimes between Maori and Pakeha, and also that it feeds into broadly based statutory planning around, for example, the Resource Management Act. I think that's where we need to go instead of a very isolated focus on legal rights.
Hi, I'm from New Zealand, and I think that's absolutely right. And I think that the ability of there being a recognition of the Whanganui River as an entity is enabled by a growing understanding by the wider population of the Māori way of thinking about and caring for the land and being one with. And I think that change needs to happen throughout the wider culture for such a thing to be able to function. And I think it begins to touch on the problematic of if we need to embrace a way of thinking in which humans don't own anything, how does that sit in a legal context? And I think that it ushers in a really interesting transition for us.
Can I ask a naive question? It seems to me that we already have in a legal system legal rights for non-human entities in the form of buildings. So, for example, some buildings have restrictions placed on whether they can be knocked down, although some governments do that anyway. I'm showing my age, I suppose, and having lived in Queensland. But for example, I suspect the building behind us has certain rights attributed to it. How does that differ then from natural? Would that be a model that one could use?
In fact, the legal rights for nature draws on long-standing ideas around corporations and non-human entities such as companies, which we have accepted have certain powers and duties and rights. That is, they can be exercised by humans on behalf of those entities. So we're very familiar with company structures, with various forms of, legal protections in place through the legal system. So that's another reason for us to think about whether the legal rights model is, and certainly it's the personhood model actually goes back to a corporate structure, and the recognition of corporate ideas goes back, for example, to the church. So we've long recognized human constructions, both physical and institutional, as having rights. So it's very belated that we come to that understanding in respect of nature.
What laws are in place when, for instance, this offset plan is used to justify going ahead with a dangerous project, and then there's no money to actually, you know, fulfill that? Where is the legal recourse for us to be sure that there's going to be enough money if they do decide that they can't afford the programs that they've promised or whatever?
Thank you.
Yeah, no. Look, being an environmental lawyer is often a depressing occupation because while we've seen some significant advances, we also, according to the swing and thrust of policy platforms, also see quite a reversal of protections in particular ways. We also in Australia have, which is where I think you're going with the Tarkai, have a very complex federal governance system, so that sometimes you, particularly with threatened species listing, see a distinction between federal protections and state-based protections. So there is a known problem here with, for example, the Flora and Fauna Guarantee Act being out of sync with the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. And also there are surprisingly limited powers to protect species against project development and so on. And I'm looking at the beautiful work on restoration here, and we're only now starting to see widespread use of what are called offsets, restoration offsets in relation to project development. Now, that is very much a compromise where we still let the development go ahead, but we then say, okay, you put conditions on that you must restore so much, maybe not even on the site. Often it will be off-site. And I've done a lot of work on biosequestration and climate change, and I've also looked quite critically at the idea of offsets and whether it will actually enhance biodiversity in the longer run.
Can I ask just a follow-up one? Do we need to change the constitution, given it was written at a time when obviously we didn't have these serious, but really, I mean, why can't we get the laws if we all kind of, you know, if there's so much evidence, what's holding that? Is it the Constitution?
Well, in part, but it's much more complex than that. The Constitution doesn't even have a right for the Commonwealth government to legislate on environment. That was achieved after a very difficult process. Sorry, Mark, I'm some space. The Tasmanian Dam project was pivotal in that the High Court found that the Commonwealth could use what are called indirect heads of power to legislate for the environment. So really in Australia, the strong impetus for environmental law came after the Tasmanian Dams case, where the Commonwealth started to enact a whole raft of environmental protections, and that was then picked up, and state governments and so on did a lot more work in that area. But it's a very difficult process to amend our constitution. You need a two-thirds majority in two-thirds of the states. We haven't successfully amended the constitution except for, the latest one was 1967, where we recognised Indigenous peoples as citizens of Australia, and that was 1967.
With, say, like the Murray-Darling Basin, which is in, you know, a number of different states, so from a legal point of view, it's going to be impossible.
Yeah, I was on the Academy of Science group that did the report on the fish kills in and around the Menindee Lakes on the Darling River. And one of the complications, yes, is federalism and how we work across what are entrenched state and territory interests to achieve a coordinated governance. And that is before we even get down to the variety of stakeholder interests at play in the Murray-Darling Basin. I have argued long and hard against water markets because of the ecological damage of moving water out of catchments and disentangling water from its location in place. I'm not a big advocate of water markets, and I think we're now starting to see some of those difficulties manifest in what I call major ecological externalities that are not captured and provided for in our water market governance models. But on the same token, we've also come a long way in terms of returning environmental flows. The challenge will be for us to maintain the momentum in returning environmental, at least some minimal levels of environmental sustainability to the Murray-Darling Basin.
I was going to say that, I mean, I think the comment about water markets is interesting. It's not an area that I'm familiar with, but it links to some degree to the offsets that you were talking about, where you damage some place and you can pay for it by restoring another place. And the reality is that the ability to restore natural environments is actually very difficult and much more expensive probably than people necessarily recognize. And I think it stems in part from our belief that somehow we're generally very good at managing things. After all, we're humans, that's what we do. And there's this quite, I think, at times unjustified optimism that you can just do an offset and it'll be fine. Just grow a few trees and there you are, you've got a brand new community. But actually, it doesn't work that way. You know, you need to bring in a whole lot of insects, you need to bring in a whole range of things. A very interesting study I published quite recently was looking at the fauna on rooftops in urban gardens, and people are trying very hard to create these kind of plant communities on high-rise rooftops and elsewhere. And what they found is that very quickly these endemic plants that they had in their gardens were very rapidly taken over by a range of much more weedy plants that ended up doing well. What that means, of course, is that you can't be a gardener like me, like, you know, you sort of put all the natives out and hope everything will work well. It doesn't actually. It requires a lot more nurturing. So I think we have this sense that we're able to manage these things and we can turn a damaged area into something that approaches something pristine. We can't do that. We can get something, it may not even be close to what it is, but it would certainly be better than an unmanaged area. But I think that we need to recognize that. And if you recognize that, then you realize that this kind of offset is not an equivalence at all, whether it's in water or whether it's in other environments.
Just wanted to pick up on a couple of things around water and also private property, actually. So we had one of our climate bites was about water, and there was some discussion around over 80% of waterways actually have privately owned properties that back onto them in Australia. And as part of the kind of law, if you own a property that backs onto waterways, then you're able to actually use that water for kind of free, you know, within reasonable use, I think is the term, which is kind of a bit vague. Do you want to make comment on that?
Yeah, actually, I teach water law, sorry. It depends what you're talking about. Actually, it's a complex situation with rivers and streams and watercourses. Under Torrens system, most of those are actually vested in the Crown. So there is not actually a private property right unless you have land title to what's known as the middle of the river or stream to actually take what are called riparian rights out of the stream. And most of those were given in the middle of the 19th century. So in some rural areas, particularly in New South Wales, Tasmania, and a bit up here in central Victoria and so on, there are what are known as riparian rights, that this is land abutting the rivers where that reasonable use doctrine of riparian rights might still operate. Here in Victoria, the courts have held that that has given way to statutory allocation processes under a series of legislation, and our current Water Act actually has extinguished riparian rights. So for people, you know, they feel they may have rights. There are existing what are called stock and domestic uses. So if you know traveling and or you want to access those stock and domestic rights, now those are meant to be very, as the name suggests, very confined rights. So those still exist. I understand that our water authorities have an eye to perhaps bringing those into the allocation net as well. So it'll be an interesting question.
And I'm not quite sure where it should fall, hopefully to both of you. But when we're looking at law and when we're looking at questioning, for instance, a decision like the approval for, you know, the water bits of the Adani, because they basically forced the CSIRO to push through this really dodgy, vague claim that the coalition could vaguely rely on. Do we have rights to scientific truths? Like, you know, things that are well understood, and yet we're having so much misleading information around.
So does anyone believe in gravity?
I do.
I don't think gravity is something that you believe in. I think gravity is something that absolutely happens. I think it's astonishing that people are asked, do you believe in climate change?
The first thing I'd probably say is that it depends which bit of the law you're talking about. Now, in terms of a minister being, you know, approving a mine project, that is part of our democratic system. So with our democratic system and ministerial responsibility for decision making, that is integral to our political, our democratic system, and thus our legal system. But in terms of thinking about then how communities intersect with that system that we have developed, where there is ministerial responsibility through the government processes, sits on a democratic election process. There are ways in which you can challenge the decision making. For example, the water baselines, I know ACF did actually bring scientific evidence about the uncertainty in relation to how much water would be taken, for example, by the mine project. This type of evidence is regularly presented in many environmental cases. The question then becomes whether it is then accepted by the court as having in some way vitiated the proper decision-making processes. So the legal test is, I'm not going to go into the technical details, but it's a quite a narrow technical test. And typically, if the minister has done all the steps, looked at the information, considered it, there is not a requirement to look to the substantive science, what we might call on the merits, under much of the existing law that is there to challenge government decision-making. So the tests are very narrow, and provided the procedural steps are taken, then the minister's decision will stand, even if you do get a judicial review challenge upheld. In most instances, what happens is that the court says there's a return to the minister to make the decision according to law. We do have some tribunals like VCAT and the Land and Environment Court in New South Wales that offers a different model. It reviews on the evidence. It is in a position to remake the decision having regard to the evidence. But this is a very specialised jurisdiction. It's not the general court process. So once you move from those specialist tribunals into the general court system, then you're much more into that narrow model of if the steps have been taken, then that decision stands.
I'm going to just for the last little bit of our discussion, move a little bit from that. So I'm going to move into a little bit of a different area of nature, just to finish us off. So I just wanted to move into, you know, go back to us sort of paying attention to nature and move into some of the stuff that I know Mark's working on. And I think this will hook in nicely with some of your research around art and aesthetics and law. So around bioinspiration and biomimicry and paying attention to nature and what humans can learn from nature. Do you want to talk about some of your work, Mark, first?
One of the challenges of being an evolutionary biologist whose interests are largely esoteric is that you know that any of the discoveries that you might make will excite you and perhaps half a dozen other people, but the world is not going to blink if you don't make those discoveries, because they're esoteric and they're satisfying curiosity. So as a biologist in that area, it's often a bit of a challenge to justify what you do to the general public, who typically say, well, as a taxpayer, what's in it for me? And most people in my area have moved more towards the kind of conservation area as saying, well, our understanding of natural systems will help conservation. And some of that's true and some of it's probably a little bit of wishful thinking. One of the areas that we've started working in my group is really does have genuine impacts on human activities. And I suppose in some ways adds value to our natural systems and in particular to understanding natural systems. So colleagues and I have set up an initiative funded by the university, which is trying to bring together people from engineering, from architecture, from biology and elsewhere to think about natural solutions to essentially human problems. So to give an illustration of that, some of you may have been on the very high-speed Japanese trains, and a problem for some of the new trains that were being built was they were going so fast that when they entered a tunnel, the air pressure was such that it created these sonic booms, and so passengers inside the train would sort of have this very uncomfortable sensation. And the problem, I think, from a physics point of view, is that you are essentially going from essentially one medium to another, from one air pressure to another. This is an issue that kingfishers routinely deal with when they're trying to catch fish, because the kingfisher is in the air, so the kingfishers being like kookaburras. The kingfisher is in the air, but the fish are in the water. So a kingfisher that's diving into the water, terns do the same thing in the sea, has a real problem making sure that the water goes beside their bill, but doesn't push the bill up into their head, in which case they no longer survive. So one of the engineers on the high-speed Japanese trains happened also to be an ornithologist, and the story goes, brought the two things together. So the very pointy front end of these high-speed Japanese trains have elements to them that are very similar to the beaks of kingfishers. And this allows not only the train to avoid having the problem of a sonic boom every time it goes into a tunnel, but it also turns out that it's more efficient, goes faster, and uses less fuel. So we're developing, I mean, I love that story, but there are lots and lots of other stories that sit around how people have been inspired by billions of years of tinkering, and in particular, billions of years in which success is built on failure. And I understand that that's critical for design projects and engineering products, that there are probably heaps of solutions out there to problems that we've faced. And provides, I suppose, in part a modest justification for doing the kinds of things that we do.
And I'd like to pick up on the interdisciplinary influences on law and talk about law and aesthetics, because if we are to bring a sense of wonder, that that often brings us to that impulse for environmental protection and better recognition of nature. Then we need to think about not just giving quite sterile legal frameworks that don't address what we sometimes call the effective ideas behind it. So there's been a strong movement in the law and aesthetics area, for example, to start thinking about engaging with art, with music, with design. And in fact, there's a lot of work being done cross-disciplinary between law and design at the moment to bring those sorts of understandings into, for example, thinking about processes for endangered species or habitat. How, for example, should a court or an international court, or how should a government tribunal or government representatives at something like the World Heritage Convention meetings, how should they think about bringing those emotions, those design principles, that alternative thinking into what has been a very technical law space? So that's some of the work that's going on at the moment. And my PhD student, Alice Palmer, has expertise both as a lawyer. She headed an international environmental advocacy group for many years, but she also has a background in art and aesthetics. So she's bringing those sorts of understandings to think about how images of environment, which are the basis, for example, for a whole range of protections, such as World Heritage protections, how they might be better understood and interpreted in these international legal forums, so that we have a better sense of the way in which, for example, treaty interpretation might include some of those connections to place and our emotive response to nature that needs to be a driving force if, you know, we are to expand protections.
Fantastic. That sounds like a good place to finish up. However, if you still have a few questions for the panel, Mark and Lee have kindly agreed that they'll hang around for another 5 or so minutes. So please come up and have a chat with them. If you could thank our panel today, that'd be fantastic. And thank you to all of you for your fantastic questions and engagement today. Thank you.
This has been a production of Climactic, a podcast collective helping local communities tell their extraordinary stories. It's our mission to help elevate the voices of the everyday heroes we're surrounded by and inspire, sustain, and motivate the climate community. We love working with local environmental groups, individuals, nonprofits, and social enterprises. So if you've got a story to tell, please just get in touch. The Climactic Collective is Mark Spencer, Rich Bowden, Maxine Baisley, Georgia Scheel, and Bronwyn Gresham. Our producer is Hazel Fidicaro. Our digital design is by Rose Fidicaro. Our climactic theme is produced by Greg Grossi, and our logo designed by Abigail Hawkins. We're also pleased to feature the music of the General Assembly. Thank you for listening to Climactic, the podcast for our climactic times.
The Climactic Collective.
This show is produced by Hear Media, a boutique audio agency in Narm, Melbourne. To learn more and get in touch, head to hearmedia.studio. That's HERE media.studio.